Welcome to another episode of the Pint and Click podcast. I'm Tony. Dave was unable to make it today, but I'm joined here with Jamie and Charlie. Charlie being a new guest, but he's also instrumental in the creation of this podcast.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for all the times you've sat here with us and recorded.
It's my pleasure to be on the other side of the microphone.
We're lucky to have you today.
We are. Dave's dealing with an emergency, so we are going to commence with our regular programming in the fashion that you guys are used to. So how we ordinarily do it is we're each going to share one thing. Jamie's going to share a book. Charlie's going to share a new album that just came out. And I'm going to talk about a movie. And then the three of us are going to talk about Lord of the Rings and how it has affected our lives.
So deeply,
yes. The original 2001 trilogy of Lord of the Rings and how... Well, we'll get into the exact details of that one once we actually get to it. So, Jamie, do you want to get us started?
Yeah. So, today I want to talk about the new collection of essays called Shrill by Lindy West. And it came out the middle of May, so it's been out for a month now. And it is a collection of essays that are surrounded by the idea of feminism and activism and phobia and size discrimination and misogyny in comedy circles and things like that, because Lindy West is a comedian and a writer, and she's possibly best known for her social media hashtag campaign, Shout Your Abortion, which got some press a while ago, which encouraged women to talk about their abortions candidly online. And it is hilarious. The whole book had me rocking. I was taking pictures of different pages and sending them to my sisters and my friends. For example, in the first essay, she was talking about all the different fat role models she had growing up on TV and how there weren't any. One of them was Lady Cluck from Disney's Robin Hood, who is a big fat chicken who takes care of Maid Marian. So she was saying, are the people that I had to look up to. So it's a unique blend of pop culture and criticism and sociology and her own personal narrative. And I think we're seeing more books like this so far, you know, in kind of like the Lena Dunham vein. But she does it really well, of having her criticism be sharp and really funny, but never becoming blasé, where we can see all the time the horrifying effects of the misogyny and the internet trolling and things like that that she talks about.
Have you read the other books by comedians that have come out?
No, Amy Schumer's is coming out pretty soon, so I really want to read that one. But I've read, you know, the Tina Fey's, Amy Poehler's.
Have you heard the audiobooks of those?
I have, and I really enjoyed them. But this definitely has more of an activist bent, where there's more anger here, and I think rightfully so. And I think women get a bad rap when you show anger a lot of times. But especially when she talks about internet trolling, because as, you know, a woman in public, she has a lot of men over Twitter specifically going after her, saying terrible things like, I hope you get raped and stuff like that. There was a particularly terrible troll experience she had that she actually later then talked about on NPR on This American Life. Someone impersonated her father who had died and created this dummy Twitter account, pulled his information and his photos from, you know, his obituary and things online, and just started harassing her. And Twitter wouldn't do anything about it. She called out this person on her own Twitter, and then he took the initiative and contacted her and was apologetic. It was probably the one and only time a troll has ever apologized in the history of the internet. Right. But apologized, saying, you know, you're a real person. This actually has effects. And he was saying that he actually took time to think about what he was doing. And so then for This American Life, they contacted that person and they actually had a conversation, and he was talking about what in his life caused him to have so much hatred versus her and against women in general. And it was really interesting to see. But the parts where she was talking about women in comedy was really fascinating, especially when we see about, like, when is a joke not a joke anymore and how far is too far, and especially with people always talking about people are too serious about things, and where is the line? I thought she did a really good exploration of it.
Great. Well, and I think comedy is just an amazing art form to express thoughts that challenge the status quo. And, like, if she's able to bring that to life in these essays, I think that's really excellent, and that it's also entertaining.
Exactly. It was really funny, and I think that makes it a lot more.
It seems like a hard balance to strike up, to talk about very serious subjects, but to still make it side-splittingly funny.
Exactly, where it's accessible and where people would, you know, be engaged while reading it. Because a lot of these things are, you know, hard to talk about and hard to deal with. So I would recommend it to anyone.
It sounds very good. All right, Charlie, do you want to fill us in on the next thing on the agenda here?
I would be happy to. I'm going to be talking about the new album by The Monkees, the band and TV show that debuted 50 years ago in 1966.
My mom has all the records that she then passed down to me sitting in the back of my closet, unfortunately.
I guess the main span of their career was 1966 to 1970. And throughout the years, they've reunited a bunch of times, done tours, done a couple of albums that, in all truth, weren't very good. And that's kind of a problem with a lot of reunion albums, with bands who were really killing it for a small period of time. Like, how do you recapture that gold? And I'm happy to report that the new album, which is called Good Times, does a really excellent job of being appealing to people who love the albums from the 60s, but also, I guess, a new audience who's into indie rock and whatnot.
That idea is really interesting to me, because when I think of The Monkees, I don't think of indie rock at all, you know. So how has that sound changed? How has it bridged that gap?
Well, I guess the main difference is this time they've kind of got together a dream team of songwriters, a lot of whom have got success in their own right. People like Ben Gibbard of Death Cab for Cutie, Adam Schlesinger of Fountains of Wayne, who also produces the album, Rivers Cuomo of Weezer, he does a very good song, Andy Partridge of XTC, Noel Gallagher of Oasis, Paul Weller of The Jam, and all of them are, in their own right, great songwriters, but also Monkees fans who have a love and an understanding for what made those early albums so good. On this album, the three surviving members of the Monkees, Mickey Dolenz, Peter Tork, and Michael Nesmith, all contribute vocals as well as original songs. But about half of the songs were originally written and partially recorded in the 60s. Hmm. So part of it does sound like a vintage album. And there is one track featuring Davy Jones on lead vocals, who died about 4 years ago. And like, none of this sounds out of place or creepy or ghoulish, which sometimes with posthumous albums can be the case. I think that it really holds together well.
So does it sounds cohesive, even though there's all these different hands in the pie.
Yeah, that was my main worry, because some of these tracks are 50 years old, and some of them were written just at the beginning of the year. And I think that a lot of credit has to go to Adam Schlesinger for making it all sound so of a piece, making the old stuff sound new and the new stuff sound old. The tone of the album is very upbeat. You know, none of the songs are very dour or serious, which can also be sort of a pitfall with baby boomer musicians who sort of, well, this might be the last one. We've got to do a lot of ballads and reclaim how serious we are. But I think that this one is very much in keeping with, like, the Monkees' greatest hits, because a lot of the songs are by the people who wrote those greatest hits. There's a song by Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart, who wrote Last Train to Clarksville. There's a Neil Diamond song, and he wrote I'm a Believer. There's a Carole King song, and she wrote Pleasant Valley Sunday. So it sort of shows the continuum of great songs and how a great song in 1966 is still a great song in 2016. I think that's a very nice thing to point out, especially considering the Monkees don't really get a lot of their due credit. Like, they're still not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
No, that's
just wrong.
I think that's really interesting, especially about bringing a whole new group of fans to it, or a group of listeners, by way of, you know, bringing the who's who of indie rock today on board. Whereas if I saw a new Monkees album, I might not be, you know, drawn to that. But if I see, oh, Ben Gibbard's on it, then I would be. So it's kind of like, I know a lot of rap or hip-hop music from the 90s only because of Girl Talk. And, you know, that was sampled on it.
Yeah.
And this is a whole different way of bringing people in by a different kind of mashup or a different kind of collaboration.
Absolutely,
so that's
cool.
That's great. And it sounds very unique in that it's doing something for a time, but also for a specific band, and that hopefully it'll start a trend, and that it'll bring current generations of musicians back to maybe other types of music, or maybe other collaborations across, you know, with these same artists.
Yeah. When they first announced the album, it just sounded like they were looking through my iTunes and seeing
what would you love together.
That's great. Well, thanks for sharing that one.
The Des Plaines Public Library does have a copy of the CD, but it is currently checked out. So
better get on that waiting list.
Exactly.
Get on it now while it's still short. Okay, I'm going to share with you now my experience with the film Moon, which is a 2009 film written and directed by Duncan Jones, who is also the director of the Warcraft movie that just hit theaters. Totally different from the movie Moon, where Warcraft is an epic fantasy movie, warring factions. Moon is a movie about someone that is working kind of in isolation on the moon. more of a suspenseful, long drawn out sci-fi style of movie, very much along the lines of The Martian, which we talked about. I would say much less science, because I think that was a mark of the novel that they brought into the movie, and just more psychology. You're following one person through his experience of being isolated for years on end. His mission is for 3 years, we learn pretty early. But there's so much in this self-contained world that they do a really good job of kind of detailing that they also don't share with you. So the suspense lies in kind of what you don't know about the situation. So he has a robotic assistant called Gertie. The main character named Sam Bell is played by Sam Rockwell, and Kevin Spacey plays the voice of Gertie. And without having too much personality, Gertie is there, but he's like a helpful butler, but he's also, you're suspicious of him because...
Ulterior motives.
And for some reason, you're not getting all the answers you want when Sam is asking him questions and things like that. So there's a really good reveal only about 20 minutes into the movie, which makes you, once you get to that point, you're like kind of hooked. And then there's more kind of in that world. But I would say that this movie is a great sci-fi in the terms of how it's putting on the screen some of these intangible, maybe more personal struggles that you wouldn't ordinarily see someone going through, or you wouldn't really see it on a screen. You'd read about it, maybe read about their internal struggles.
Because psychological nuance is so hard to display on screen, to have people act it out, whereas, you know, you could have pages about someone's inner torment. But
It seems like this and The Martian and Gravity, it seems like there's sort of a trend to very small cast movies set in space, which sort of highlights the like the
human
inner
element, or the inner,
right,
and like the loneliness amongst like the vastness of space.
Yeah, definitely,
because we've had so many space movies that are so, you know, explosions and these huge casts of characters, and 12 people need to go save this, you know, us from this asteroid. But we're having a lot more of like the narrowing and focusing in on the actual mental psyche.
I think you could probably also throw The Revenant in there, because it seems like the more characters a movie has, the harder it is to zoom in on one character's internal struggle.
One of the reasons I think the space is perfectly suited for the big screen right now, and these personal experiences are too, these one person, almost like personal experiences, I think it's because maybe our relationship to technology has changed so much in the last 10 years or so.
Right.
You know, yeah. That's why I'm really interested to see Independence Day 2 and how it's different than Independence Day 1.
Oh, that's a really good point.
Yeah, based on our technological changes and how we view space exploration right now, whereas we don't really, like, NASA or, you know, the Apollo missions or the moon isn't really part of our consciousness in the same way that it was, you know, 20 years ago or something like that, or not as many kids dream of being an astronaut.
Well, maybe that'll change with all these new movies.
Movies and small companies that are taking on the space exploration herald, like Tesla and SpaceX. Okay, so moving on to the final topic of our podcast. I'm sure Dave is going to be a little bit regretful that he wasn't here to talk about it.
I'm already regretful that I'm here to talk about it.
We'll be easy on you.
Jamie, do you want to lead us into this?
Okay, so we're going to talk about Lord of the Rings, which is a topic very near and dear to my heart and to many of the people who work here at the library, although apparently not Charlie, but you're new, so you can be inducted. And we're thinking about, so it's been 15 years since Lord of the Rings came out. And yet the way that I feel in relationship to these movies is the same way as I felt when I was 12 years old in a movie theater, having never read The Lord of the Rings before, and just going in and my mind being blown away by this world and these creations and the depth of the characters. And, you know, I've seen it pretty much every year since then. It's our family tradition to rewatch all three extended editions. And I still feel the same way. And I feel like that's really rare. And my wedding is coming up, and it is going to be somewhat Lord of the Rings themed. I just had a Shire-themed bridal shower. So it's clearly made a big impact on my life. But how would you say that your relationship has changed or not changed, Tony?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, just rewatching The Two Towers recently, I think, like you, I was completely blown away even by a trailer of that movie when it first came out. Whereas today, you know, when there's so many different special effects and CG characters I'm just so surprised that I'm still completely absorbed by the character of, like, Gollum, for example, you know. And I remember there was even an Oscars where, like, Gollum came on and accepted the award for, like, best animation in a film or something. So the sense of wonder still has not left me at all. And I think the thing about Lord of the Rings is it was probably the first widely accepted culturally, it's like culturally okay to be a fan of like elves, dwarves, kings, mountains, dragons, and things. So like it is totally a milestone in my life for sure.
This nerdy, really nerdy element that is very mainstream.
Very mainstream now. Exactly. And I think that just changed something for a lot of people.
Right.
And, you know, so.
And I think when we were talking about how it's harder to get into the inner struggle when there's so many characters, with Lord of the Rings, there are so many characters. And I remember my relatives saying they all look the same about different elves, and they got Boromir confused with Faramir, or got confused with, you know, every other character. But Frodo's struggle, even though I do still think that Frodo's the most boring character in the thing, is we can see the layers of it. We can see the nuance of that, and him and Sam's relationship, and the things that Gandalf goes through as he moves from Gandalf the Grey to Gandalf the White. All of these things are layered and developed, even though there's nine people in the Fellowship plus multitudes of other characters and races. And I think that's something that it's really difficult to get across in movies. Like, look at the Avengers, where they have an equally large cast. You can't get as deep into the psychology of different characters in that way.
Right. And they spend entire films on those characters, which is really fascinating. But like sometimes the story itself, in order to tell a story, even in a 2.5 hour long Avengers movie, they have to like sideline some of those characters away from the main plot. Whereas I think in, let's say even Fellowship of the Ring, you have characters like Boromir, who's definitely a supporting character, but plays just such a central role and has such a deep inner conflict that is representative in so many other characters in the entire series. And yeah, it just, it's great how, so, okay, so you haven't seen Fellowship, so I probably don't need to spoil it.
I think I may have given the wrong impression. So before I get any angry emails, I don't hate The Lord of the Rings. I only have seen the second one, The Two Towers, and I saw it in the movie theaters back when it first came out, because I had a tendency to only see the middle one of a trilogy or the...
Why? Why would you put yourself through that horror?
I just didn't go see movies very often. And when I would, you know, there would be friends who would, do you want to see the second Matrix movie? Can you talk me through the first one on the way there? All right. I saw the fifth through last Harry Potter movies. So my knowledge and memory of the movie is very spotty. I was impressed by the special effects and just the scope of it. But I think that I was also put off by the scope of it, because these are very long movies. They're about 3 hours. And you say that you watch the extended versions.
Which is closer to a four.
Right. And so if I was to set aside a day and just like 12 hours and watch nothing but Lord of the Rings, I probably could. But part of me thinks that my brain would seize up and and freeze, and I would have to restart myself.
But why have you never watched The Fellowship or The Return of the King, you know, just separately, not all in the same day since then?
I don't know. It's anything that involves a lot of world building, I've got sort of a mental block where I think, oh, this is going to take up way too much time. I'm going to start having dreams about this.
Well, I think the beauty of Lord of the Rings is that the world building, to me, it seemed pretty seamless. And granted, The Fellowship of the Ring, the pacing is much slower than the other two, because you have to set up everything. But especially in some other books, the way that they deliver the information about the world is much more plotting or separate. But I felt like in Lord of the Rings, especially in the movies, the way that we understand the world just comes through it so fluidly. And there is that narration part at the beginning of The Fellowship of the Ring, where the screen is pretty black, and then they just talk us through the background of the ring. But in a way that is so engaging and so compelling and just draws you in.
Like a storybook. I mean, like a storybook. Like the first few pages or page even, like the fancy illumination of like a really good introduction. So I think if you started there, you might be
hooked. Start at the beginning?
Yeah.
You might
be
hooked.
What a shocking, you know, revelation.
Not to sweat you for it. But yeah, in reality, I think the story, even The Hobbit probably suffers from being kind of in the middle of things, even though it's a prequel, whatever, you know.
And that's the trilogy that recently came out.
That recently came out, right.
And these are all based on the same set of Tolkien books?
Well, it was based on The Hobbit, which is kind of like the prequel, because it's definitely more of a children's book than Lord of the Rings. And It's about Bilbo Baggins, who was Frodo's predecessor. But it's also very much based on a lot of the Lord of the Rings lore and stuff that was in the...
Oh, like the appendix?
The appendices and things like that. So they use a lot of the world. So a lot of the information is not just from the Hobbit book, but it was pretty unwieldy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good word, unwieldy.
Yeah. Right. And Peter Jackson has admitted since then that he would run into his trailer and try to finish scenes that they would just do right after that. Mm-hmm. You know, they would all have to wait while he was finishing the next part. So it was less put together. Mm-hmm. But I think watching it back again, you can see, like you said, Tony, that I'm still impressed by the special effects and things like that. And you can kind of see the difference, obviously, between Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit in developments in technology. But it's not to the part where it distracts me at all. The characters and the plot points that's going on totally pulls me away from the fact that, oh, maybe we can see the scenes a little bit more than if the movie came out 15 years later.
Would you say your perception of the larger story has changed much over time, or even like the fantasy races or anything like that? Like, do you see orcs differently now that you've witnessed the Boltons or something?
Exactly. Well, Jackie, who used to work here, what she would always say, she's like, when you're young and you watch Lord of the Rings, you're in love with Legolas. And then you get a little older and you realize that Aragorn is like the perfect man. And then you get older and you realize you've reached like maturity is when you realize like Faramir is the perfect is the perfect dude to be with. But I think the epic story of Lord of the Rings is epic because it's universal in some ways and it's so tied to humanity, even though these are like really large, vague words that I'm using. How can I make this more specific?
I mean, there's a conflict of good and evil for sure within that. And that's one of the things that I noticed right away when I was watching The Two Towers again, is that there was a clear good and evil. And it's strange to think that that's really a universal conflict. But then there's so many shades of evil and shades of good.
Like you were saying, like Boromir, like that level of being pulled in two different forces and trying to please your father versus trying to do what's right and things like, and then going back to Game of Thrones, like the Theon Greyjoy conflict is somewhat similar to that too. But I think the bonds of friendship as I grew up just are more and more poignant to me. Where it's something that when I was younger, I didn't really think about as much, but just the idea of the actual word fellowship and of their dedication and devotion to each other is less and less seen, I think, as you age, and has been more evocative for me.
That's great.
Yeah, I know that there is something to it, because otherwise it wouldn't be as popular as it is. But I think I'm just going to chalk it up to laziness. And you've made a very good case that I should, if just for the sake of being, you know, culturally literate.
I know, you're missing out on so many memes. If you're, like, there's just so many meme jokes you're not going to get if you haven't seen the first and the third one.
Yeah, you do not simply start at episode two and expect to...
I'm pretty sure that that's a reference.
Yeah, that's a reference. Maybe sometime if one of us are having a marathon of sorts, we could just invite you to join us. And
That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
You don't have to watch The Hobbits, and I won't make you watch all the different parts about how they put the costumes together or how they found the locations in New Zealand or anything like that, because that could be, you know, hours and hours and hours.
Yeah, you don't need the extra features.
The commentary.
Great. So that concludes this episode of Pine and Click Podcast. I also want to wrap up with a special congratulations to Jamie, who is going to get married real soon here.
And we are having like a Legolas wig and a Gimli beard for our photo booth. So fantastic. I can dress up.
Awesome. Excellent.
Those are definitely good ones to share.
Congratulations.
So congratulations from Dave, too. He's not here to say it, but his sentiment hopefully is felt.
Thank you.